Welcome to a very special podcast. The USS Midway Museum presents American Patriots, Stories from the Flight Deck. I'm John DiBello, along with the Midway's own Scott McGaw, and we are about to hear a pretty amazing story, Scott, told by some very special naval aviators.
You're right, and by extension, that specialness extends to more than 150,000 sailors who served over 47 years aboard the USS Midway. Their average age was only 19.
Yeah.
Just imagine a ship that served the entire length of the Cold War, Korea, Vietnam, Cuban Missile Crisis, all the way through Operation Desert Storm, a ship that was once the largest ship in the world for a decade. And today has the opportunity to become really a living testament to courage and sacrifice in uniform. Right here in downtown San Diego, the birthplace of naval aviation, the original home of Top Gun, it really has become a perfect storm. And I'm privileged, along with 150 employees and 1,000 volunteers, to be part of that effort.
Well, you know, you welcome, what, over a million people a year to the Midway now, don't you?
We do. You know, we worked for 12 years to bring Midway to San Diego, and in all of that time of business planning,
yeah,
if you will,
yeah,
we never envisioned the success that Midway has been able to enjoy, largely because of our volunteers and the men who we are honoring in this podcast. 1.4 million visitors, 250 private events, 400 active duty Navy ceremonies,
that's
retirements,
incredible.
Reenlistments.
And growing.
And growing.
And growing.
We're setting a record every year. And we've become quite an international destination. A lot of people don't realize that Mandarin is now the most commonly spoken foreign language on Midway.
How is your Mandarin, Scott?
Not as good as it should be. In fact, I'm going to China on a sales mission here in a few months. I do need to brush up a little bit beyond ni hao.
I can understand that. Well, as we talk about the Midway and all of those sailors contributing to what it accomplished, it launched over 300,000 aircraft on many sorties and multiple American combat missions over five decades. I had the chance, to talk to four of these gentlemen who flew off American carriers during Vietnam, and we talked to them on the flight deck. And we're going to come back to their story on Midway, but we're going to start by talking about their story in Vietnam. And it was pretty incredible. Let's go back five decades in their memory and listen to their story.
Here I was on my 285th combat mission, and you always think that, well, it's always going to happen to the other guy, it's not going to happen to you. Well, suddenly it was happening to me, and I can hear myself say, oh my God, no.
When all of a sudden there was a bunch of little golf balls coming by my canopy up there, which were off of MiG-17.
And about that time, the airplane blew up.
We were not going to quite make it, and I'm swapping altitude for airspeed all the way down, and then I'm running out of altitude.
We always thought, well, either I come back or I get killed. You know, that we just forgot all about this stuff in the middle.
The stuff in the middle. You've just heard a quartet of naval aviators, and they're recounting the final moments of their last mission over Vietnam, Scott. I mean, all four were shot down, and then they collectively endured more than 5,000 days of captivity between them. Now, that's a gripping story in itself, but there's a special connection here that makes it even more compelling. Scott, you've written a total of seven books, three about the USS Midway. And you spend pretty much all your waking hours on the Midway, or maybe it just seems that way.
It's close to that. I've never been involved with anything remotely as rewarding, John. My wife and I have 39 years marriage, have only one rule that I really do follow, is, and that is, I'm not allowed to go down to Midway before 6:30 in the morning each day, because if I could, I would.
Well, you just talked about volunteers and the stories that we're going to begin to tell from the gentlemen we just heard talking about their final mission in Vietnam. All of them are volunteers. They're docents on the Midway, aren't they?
They are. They are a part of what we call our world-famous docent corps, 400 now docents. On any given day, there will be 30, 40, 50 of them aboard, stationed throughout the ship, sharing their stories with visitors from around the world. They're often, most of them are Navy veterans. A number of them served aboard Midway. So if you're lucky, you'll listen to a docent literally talking in the first person of what it was like aboard Midway, not just in Vietnam. It could have been during the Korean War, or literally in the earliest days of the Cold War, right after World War II.
Well, we're going to hear all four of them talking in first person, and they are all part of something special this year, aren't they? The Midway American Patriot Award. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's a very important fundraiser for our education program, raising scholarships for San Diego schools children to visit Midway. Each year, we honor great American patriots, and that can come in many different ways. We've been privileged to honor Pete Wilson, San Diego mayor, governor, senator, John McCain, a prisoner of war and certainly known for his public service, Lee Iacocca, for his work on the bicentennial in 1976. This year, we didn't have to go very far. When we reflected on the 50th anniversary of Vietnam, the naval aviators who flew off Midway, several of them not to return after being shot down, in some cases being killed, in other cases becoming prisoners of war and serving in an entirely different context. It is those men representing all of naval aviation and all those who served in Vietnam who are our honorees this year.
Outstanding. And I guess there were about, 179 naval aviators who became Vietnam prisoners of war. And these four gentlemen sort of represent all of them as we look to this year's award. And I'm going to listen to the first two very quickly now, Jack Ench and Will Abbott. And we're going to hear from them with a very similar experience that took place a few years apart. And this is what went down on their last day in the air.
Mike Doyle and I were flying together. And luckily, I'm not superstitious because we were on our 13th mission together that day. On the 25th of August, 1972, we got taken under fire by a number of surface-to-air missile batteries up there.
I was hit right in the canopy. I kind of was unconscious, maybe for a few seconds. I ejected. My right leg is sticking up like that, foot sticking out like that, and it was pretty clearly that it was broken. And then it's all tangled up in the shroud lines up there, so the parachute wouldn't open.
The next thing I remembered was hanging in my chute, and both elbows had been dislocated and pushed halfway up my arm. So I'm floating down in a parachute with no helmet, looking at people on the ground shooting at me. And I thought, oh my God, you know, this is it, I'm gone. Yeah, but luckily they were either bad shots or I wasn't in the air long enough to pick a good target. And I ended up in the Hanoi Hilton.
That was Jack Ench, and as he said somewhat wryly, maybe they were bad shots, but at any rate, he ended up in some place called the Hanoi Hilton. And Scott, we know what that is, but a lot of people don't. What was the Hanoi Hilton?
It was the largest prisoner of war camp in North Vietnam. However, it was not the only one. There were a number of others, one ironically called Camp Hope. I wonder what individual came up with that and in what circumstances.
Yeah.
But it was a place. Those were places where our neighbors, our fathers, our husbands spent anywhere from 6 months to more than 8 years in captivity. Something that only after the war did we truly come to appreciate what they endured.
Well, that was back in the 60s, and I was a kid, and one of the top TV shows was Hogan's Heroes, which was a TV show about a happy prison camp in World War II, with a lap track and everything.
No blood, no dislocated shoulders, always food on the table, a far cry from what these men endured.
No kidding. And Will Stark was shot down in May 1967. He was flying from the USS Enterprise. He takes us back to those first moments on the ground, and it wasn't pleasant.
I'm aching some with a broken leg, a broken knee, and a broken arm. And the first English I had heard from any of the Vietnamese was, "For you, the war is over." They were wrong. The war continued. And now my war became one with my captors. Everyone got the initial torture session. Name, rank, serial number, date of birth, that went fine. The fourth question, what ship are you from? And I didn't answer. You've got to tell us. And I said, no. And then it began. Slaps and kicks and cuffed up alongside the head. We're not making any progress. And then it got serious for them. And now I'm hanging, inverted. Head and arms not quite touching the ground. And finally, I got to the point where I couldn't handle it anymore. They weren't going to kill me. And I said, okay, I'll tell you. I'm from the Kitty Hawk, which was an obvious lie. They knew it to be an obvious lie because on my flight jacket, when they picked me up, my flight suit, it had Enterprise. They didn't need the answer to that question. They could hand me my butt on a tray. And that was the purpose, to beat me down for future sessions.
So that was Will Stark recounting his first few days in a North Vietnamese prison camp. And Scott, that's a blow-by-blow, and literally in this case, that's a horrible story. But, you know, Jack Ench, who also went through the same thing, he said the POWs called them quizzes, which I guess is a very nice way of saying a torture session.
Exactly right.
And he survived 3+ days of that treatment nonstop with 2 broken arms. And Bill Stark was very proud of the fact, and he really made that clear to me when we talked. He never made a confession, never signed a letter of any kind. And the reason was his captors knew it was going to take them way too long to acquire anything from him.
I've been privileged to write 7 books, mostly about military history. And something I have found in every single one is that every man, I think woman as well, in uniform, finds an inner wellspring of perseverance, faith, optimism, that enables them to endure whatever it is, whether it's the battlefield of the Civil War or a prisoner of war camp. To survive, I think, combat, everyone has to find that. And, of course, it's individualized. Everyone is different.
Right.
But it really is a common denominator I've seen time and time again.
And again, a common denominator is the captor is always going to try to break down the captive, and sometimes solitary confinement in addition to the beatings. And in Vietnam, this is really interesting because they tried that. But the POWs came up with something called the TAP code, which I think is fascinating. Here's Will Abbott talking about the TAP code.
The TAP code that was brought in by POW number 5, Smitty Harris. He remembered it from his Boy Scout handbook. Before that, everybody had been trying to use Morse code. And Morse code going through the wall just didn't work very well. So the TAP code was perfect. You know, it's just a matrix of the alphabet. It was easily taught to everybody. So when I got there in 1966, the TAP code was pretty well around. The Vietnamese had it. They knew that people were tapping, and they tortured enough guys, a couple of guys long enough to get the TAP code from them. But so what? They really couldn't work it. So we had the TAP code and could use it there. And we used the TAP code for everything. We used it tapping on the wall. You could wave a plate up in the window up there to flash it across.
So that was the TAP code, tapping on a wall. He says you could wave a plate. Fascinating.
It is, because, of course, one of the primary weapons in any prisoner of war camp is isolation. And the TAP code, or any variation thereof, was specifically designed to counter that, so that men knew they were not alone, both in terms of the man in the next cell around the corner, and by extension, hopefully reminding him that he had families and others supporting him back home.
Well, and one thing that was I thought was interesting was how innovative and yet how simple it was at the same time. And Will made a very interesting point. Did you know our government, actually classified the TAP code for a couple of years after Vietnam? Will thought that was hilarious
because the
North Vietnamese knew it existed. They just sort of couldn't stop it.
They couldn't. It was, I thought, extraordinary ingenuity really for the sake of sanity, as much as anything else, I suppose, for these men. You look back at what they not just endured, but how they found different, incredibly ingenious ways to cope. That in itself is a source of inspiration to this day.
Well, and one thing was they talked about the bond between them. You couldn't be isolated. You had to be in a group. You had to get along with your fellow captives. But that sort of filled a gaping hole, and that gaping hole was the complete loss of their family and everything they
had. Can you imagine being 28 and your wife is back home in Coronado and you've got a couple of kids in elementary school? It may be 6 months or a year before they know whether you're even alive, in cases that happened on several instances.
Yeah, and Will Stark talked about that.
My wife knew I had been captured, but she didn't know what had happened to me for 3 years. She had the tough role. I knew where I was, and I knew what I was called upon to do and did to the best of my ability. She had no idea. You're looking for heroes in our family? She's the hero.
Will Abbott mentioned that his wife was working with Sybil Stockdale on an effort. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sybil Stockdale, wife of Jim Stockdale, ultimately Admiral Stockdale, and others founded the National League of Families and American Prisoners Missing in Southeast Asia. That really was a turning point in some respects in terms of this nation's awareness and support for POWs. You know, when a man or woman goes to combat, mm-hmm. one of the most important things they have to believe is that they will not be left behind. Whether they're wounded on the battlefield, whether they're killed on the battlefield, whether they're captured. And thanks to Sybil and others, they really made the POW situation in Vietnam part of the daily national headlines and really contributed to the war effort in their own way.
Well, some of those guys were there a remarkably long time. You know, it's interesting. Jack Ench said that he was shot down in 1972. He wasn't there that long. He was one of the new guys, the FNGs, as they called them.
That's
we won't
right.
go into detail on that,
that's
he was an FNG.
That's classified.
But he said that had he gone down when he started in 1966, he would have been there for about 7 years.
Yes, and I've interviewed other POWs off Midway. In one case, the aviator was classified as killed in action. The family was notified. The life insurance was paid out. Mom and the kids go on about their business, and it was 4 or 5 years before they learned that Dad was still alive, and he ultimately came home with Jack as well.
Well, after that period of time, it's February 1973, something called Operation Homecoming is commencing. And that really became the final major action of America's war in Vietnam. Will Stark and Jack Ench remember.
Walked us out through the Heartbreak Hotel. Across the street, a lot of Vietnamese people. They weren't throwing flowers as Ho Chi Minh predicted they would do on the day that we left Vietnam, but they weren't throwing anything else either.
And we crossed the Vietnamese coast on the way to Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. And the pilot came across the intercom and he said, "We are exiting Vietnam airspace and we're now in international airspace over the Tonkin Gulf." And the plane just erupted. I mean, we just went crazy. Yay!
Indeed, that was a special time, a unique time, certainly in that generation of American history. And we really needed, as a nation, to find something good to feel about when it came to Vietnam. As I mentioned earlier, 58,000 killed, 300,000 wounded. To see our most fathers and husbands come home, to know that America did not leave them behind in the aftermath of so much tragedy, so much loss, mm-hmm. so much bloodshed.
Yeah.
It was something this country really needed. And to this day, the POWs who I've spoken with recognize that and are humbled by it.
Well, you know, all four of the guys that I talked to basically had the same feeling that you just talked about. But then again, we've only mentioned three of the four so far, Bill Stark, Will Abbott, Jack Ench. But there is a fourth. His name is Ev Southwick. And his Vietnam experience went all the way back to the action that actually precipitated the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized an American military response that would ultimately lead to war. Now, he was shot down 4 days before Bill Stark. They actually flew together in training.
Yes.
And to a man, these guys don't consider themselves special. And I think Ev summed it up perfectly.
We don't look upon ourselves as being heroes by any stretch of the imagination. But when we came home, the war was so divisive in this country that I think Americans were looking for some heroes, and we filled the bill. We were overwhelmed, absolutely overwhelmed.
Well, you know, with all due respect to Ev and his service to country and his service to Midway, I would disagree.
Yeah, I think so, huh?
That he's not a hero.
Well, there's an interesting angle, too. You know, you'd think these guys would come back and try to put this out of their mind as quickly as possible. And yet, two of the four aviators that I talked to went back to Vietnam afterwards.
I'm flabbergasted whenever I think about that, that I can't begin to imagine what they endured, what their families endured, and then 10, 15, even 30 or 40 years later, they can get to a place in their minds and in their hearts that allows them and even makes them want to go back to Vietnam and to a certain extent re-experience what they endured.
Well, sir, you know, it was interesting. Will Stark said he went back, and his takeaway was, we are quote-unquote damned lucky to be here, because he went back to North Vietnam. He had some time to sort of think about what he went through, and his patriotism didn't flag at all. If anything, I think he was prouder of what he did by going back.
Yes, absolutely. I hear that all the time. I think, if truth be known, they're proud, I think, of themselves being able to get to that point where they can go back and literally shake the hands of enemy pilots. Well, that they endured.
Exactly. And we talked about Ev Southwick a little bit and what was special about his story. And yeah, he went back, like Will Stark, with the people that imprisoned him, tortured him, and they're lifting a glass together.
Yeah, Yes, and I don't get it, to be honest with you. I just can't imagine getting to a place, as I mentioned earlier, on both sides. You know, my father fought in World War II, and he never got there.
Yeah,
when it came to the Germans and what he called the Japanese, yeah. That generation. Maybe it's just the way we are today and we've evolved to some extent. But to see these men, if not embrace, at least openly acknowledge what they endured and get to a place of reconciliation and understanding is inspiring.
Yeah, and I asked Ed that question, and his answer was pretty simple and pretty straightforward.
I've never hated the Vietnamese people, for goodness sakes. It's the system, that totalitarian system, can never succeed because it doesn't utilize the creativity and the potential that all human beings have.
Scott, that was a sentiment that all of them shared with me. Very, very genuine. In fact, Jack Ench, he told me, and I thought this was remarkable. He said the smallest jail cell is right between your temples, right inside your head.
What great advice. What great insight. What great perspective that we can take from heroes like Jack. If that is something that he could develop such an awareness under his circumstances, I don't know about the DiBello family, but certainly for the McGaw family, we don't have any issues that are that big that we can't find a way inside our own heads.
Exactly.
To cope.
He just had this sense of equanimity, even
yes.
speaking about it. And he
yes.
said something that I thought was just wonderful. Here it is.
The Lord's Prayer says what? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those. And so, well, it was good enough for Jesus. I guess it's good enough for Jack Ench. The POW experience was a part of my life. It wasn't the end of my life. I came home and I had a life.
Well, I tell you what, they did indeed have a life, and it continues to this day, and we're all better off for it. Most remained on active duty. They continued to serve their country. They continued to be prepared to sacrifice even more for their country. Some became career officers. Others went on into private life. Jack Ench became the executive officer of something called Top Gun.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, right.
I've
here in San
that.
Diego.
Yeah.
Along with Muggs McCune, setting new standards in naval aviation. Ev Southwick ultimately graduated from law school and served both the government, NASA, local government right
mm-hmm.
here in San Diego.
Yep. And Bill Stark was an amazing story. After he retired from the Navy, he worked in banking. And then in 1986, he began yet what I would call another extraordinary career. He became the oldest person ever to graduate from the San Diego Police Academy.
Will Abbott was on loan from the Air Force as an exchange officer.
He went on to command the 21st Fighter Wing after he got out of Vietnam.
Yes, several of these
up in Alaska.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of these POWs went on to very, very accomplished careers, not just as aviators, but as leaders. And yet, when you look back at the careers of all four of these men, they all have a commonality that is remarkable.
They all came back to the Midway, didn't they?
They all did. You know, we've had many docents come up to us privately over the years and say, honestly, if Midway wasn't here, we'd be dead.
Well, you know, you said 1.4 million people every year from around the world come onto the Midway. As I understand it, it's America's most visited naval ship museum.
In fact, it's the world's most visited. There you go.
And growing every year.
That's right.
I have a question for you. Do the people seeing the docents, hearing some of the stories, know who these guys are?
Regrettably, no. In the context that you're literally asking it, our docents and these men, they share their stories in many ways. They don't go oftentimes into a lot of personal depth with guests, depending upon the context of where they are on the ship and what they're talking about, whether it's landing or taking off on a flight deck or something like that. Sometimes they begin to share if you ask the right questions, but they do not wear this on their sleeves. They do not wear it as a badge of honor in their minds. When the context is appropriate and the storyline goes in that direction or the conversation, yes, it will come up, but they're not preaching.
That's amazing. And, you know, they really do underscore with their presence. I think one of your goals at the Midway, which is to make the Midway America's living symbol of freedom. Tell me what that means.
The operative word, John, is living. And it's exactly what we're talking about here today. The men and women who volunteer first to serve our country and then to serve aboard Midway and really embody what being an American is all about, what being a patriot is all about. There are lots of symbols of American freedom, you know, from the Liberty Bell to the Statue of Liberty. But aboard Midway, we focused on, the backs of those individual Americans who create the legacy of service and sacrifice in uniform.
Well, you talk about the idea of living. Those people are literally living their story on the deck every day.
Yes, they are.
And all of them do it, these four in particular, but even of these four, one in particular, Jack Inch, has a really interesting and unique perspective. Let's listen to Jack for a second talk about the Midway.
I did two cruises on Midway. I also have one more catch shot than I have landing on a Midway because I didn't come back from my last mission on Midway. So, you know, she still owes me one.
Wow, Scott, that was Jack Inch. You know, I think we owe him one.
Absolutely.
I think he'd agree. And every one of 179 Naval Aviator Vietnam prisoners of war.
Yes. You know, and fortunately, many of them are still with us today, including the four that we're honoring as great American patriots aboard the flight deck of the USS Midway, Will Abbott, Ev Southwick, Bill Stark, and Jack Inch. I can't imagine more worthy co-recipients of the 2017 Midway American Patriot Award.
I totally agree. And they are continuing a great tradition that you've established at the Midway with the Midway American Patriot Award, and most certainly worthy of all this recognition. Scott, it's been great today.
My pleasure, John.
It has been absolutely fascinating, and you are fascinating.
Well,
having written seven books and being the man on the Midway literally every day, as you say, although not before 6:30 a.m. in the morning.
That's right. Let's be clear about that. That's right.
But you are going to come back, and we are going to talk more. We have more stories in our series. This has been fantastic. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'm John DiBella.